All right, let's do it. You guys ready? We're already there. We're just going to keep going in the same direction. Let me set the stage again, though, before we get into John chapter 3, because we always want to keep in mind the big picture of what's going on in the Gospel of John as we make our way through the book. We talked about it before, and you can turn there if you like, John 20, 30, and 31. The writer of this book, the Apostle John, does something very generous. He tells us why he wrote the book. That's huge. You guys know that in any piece of literature. And here John tells us why. And so we're going to start here to see how John 3 fits in with it. But John 20, 30, and 31, the author tells us, "And truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." Now, we've talked about this in more detail, but essentially, John tells us a couple really important things. The main thing we always want to remember is that John wrote this book for the purpose of proving that Jesus is the Messiah. And that in proving it to the reader, that the reader might believe, and that in believing, the reader might have life in his name. That's the reason why John wrote the book, and I really believe that that's our reason for studying the book. For life, if you don't already know Jesus, an abundant life. Abundant life for all of us in here that do know Jesus. So, John tells us, I'm going to prove that Jesus is the Messiah. And the main way he's going to do this, he says, is that Jesus has done many other signs. He's done all kinds of signs. Remember, signs aren't just miracles, but they point us to something, just like a road sign. Yes, it's a miracle, but it points to something greater. That's why Jesus did the signs. But John says, I'm going to select a handful of signs in order to prove it to you. So what we have going on here is the author saying, I am going to make a case. I'm going to prove something to you. Now, we remember from, and you guys can make your way back to John 3, but we remember from the first chapter, especially verses 1, 14, and 18, really what we have is the premise upon which he's going to build his case. The whole thing that he's trying to prove is that Jesus is God. Verse 14, that he is God manifest in the flesh. And verse 18, that even though no one has seen the Father, that Jesus is actually a perfect representation, manifestation of the Father. So this is the premise. And then what he does is, and we can look at it very much like a legal case, somebody trying to make a legal case. First of all, I'm going to make a case. Second of all, this is what I'm going to prove, that Jesus is God, that he's God manifest in the flesh. Now I'm going to bring out some witnesses, and he does that in chapter 1. John the Baptist himself, the apostle, he talks about what many believe is his own testimony of Jesus calling him to follow him. Either way, you have the witnesses of these apostles, that these disciples at this time that choose to follow him. And throughout the Gospel of John, you have many other witnesses. You have God the Father himself. Remember, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. We have the Scriptures themselves, the Old Testament, bearing witness. So it follows perfect logic. Going to prove a case. Here's what I'm going to prove. Here's my witnesses. And then in chapter 2, and I want to just remind you of this because I didn't have the opportunity to be with you for chapter 2. My dad was here, and it sounds like it went great, and I'm super blessed by that. But one thing, just as we keep our big whole perspective of the Gospel of John, is that in chapter 2, John the Apostle does exactly what he says he's going to do. He brings his first sign. He shows the first sign that Jesus did, which was turning water into wine in Cana of Galilee. Now, even though the second half of that chapter, we see Jesus coming into the temple during a feast time, and we see him lifting up tables and turning over tables and basically cleansing the temple, right? Even though that might not necessarily be considered a miracle, it's still a sign. And I love the fact that, okay, in chapter 2, it follows the whole progression of this book. Okay, the first signs are laid out for us. And you have on one hand a sign that shows Jesus as being so personal, so intimate, caring for these disciples, being at a wedding, rejoicing with them. It's really a lighthearted sign. And then in the second half of the chapter, you have what really is a sign of great gravity, because he's going through the temple and he's turning over tables and he's made a whip out of it, you know, and he's just beating people out of there. You see two very different things, but I think it's perfect. Right in that chapter, you see two sides, and really what it tells you is there's a balance to this whole thing. There's a balance. You can't fall on one side or the other. But again, just as we have a whole perspective, it's just so important that we remind ourselves that this is what's going on. And now we find ourselves after these first two signs have been presented to us in chapter 2. We have chapter 3, another amazing chapter. I mean, right off the bat, we all know the most famous verse of the Bible right there, John 3:16, huge. I hope none of us get used to it. I hope none of us going into this chapter, we're going, oh man, I know this one, because we have so much more to learn. And we'll talk about some of those things tonight. The first thing I just want to point out to you, our first main point in John chapter 3, is not just this guy, Nicodemus, but the whole scenario, the whole situation of a guy coming to Jesus and Jesus, God manifested in the flesh, just having a one-on-one conversation with him. We can't miss just how huge that is. God of the universe just having a conversation with a person. This is the first of two conversations that we're going to be going over in this week and next week, because next week we have the woman at the well. Another amazing situation where God manifests in the flesh, has a conversation with a person, a life-changing conversation with a person. And really, again, we can see a perfect balance. One of them, a religious person, a very religious person, a leader, a ruler of the Jews. The other, a Samaritan woman who's a sinner, who has a wreck of a life. Same Jesus, talking with these two people. And again, let's not miss, before we even get to what they're talking about, let's not miss how cool that is, that God of the universe is talking with somebody. So this guy Nicodemus comes to Jesus at night. We know that. Many of you have probably heard, and maybe you feel this way yourself, which you certainly have the right to, that you've maybe heard that Nicodemus was a coward because he came to Jesus by night. He didn't want other people necessarily to know that he was there. I don't personally fall on that side. I look at it and go, okay, here's a guy. We know some things about it. He's a Pharisee. He's a ruler of the Jews. Everything about the text and the language tells us that he was prominent. Not just as a Pharisee, which to begin with was prominent in society because you're a religious leader of a religious people. But he was prominent even among the Pharisees, a ruler of the Jews. Remember, Jesus later on says, are you not the teacher of Israel? Now, partially that may have been a bit of a jab to him. It doesn't necessarily mean he was the main one, but it tells us that there was something very prominent about him. So this is something interesting to take in. Also, let's not make the mistake of going, when we go through the text, of forgetting how smart this guy Nicodemus really was. It's easy for us, as soon as Nicodemus says, how can a man go back into his mom's belly and be born again? It's easy for us to count this guy out, right? To just go, what kind of an idiot is that? You know, this guy's kind of foolish. He's very smart. And there's a lot going on in the conversation. I want to step back for a moment and just make an observation that every one of you guys here tonight have decided to forego watching the presidential debate live. for whatever reasons. Maybe it's not that important. Maybe you're recording it. I know I'm interested in it. I'll at least fast forward through it. I'm recording it as well. I'm also recording the Dodger game. And Lonnie was kind enough to tell me the score, which I really appreciate. I don't want to hear any more about it. I'm going to watch it at home, probably before the debate too. But I bring the debate up for a certain reason. What you have going on are two guys. One of them, for sure, I mean, barring anything completely crazy, one of them is very soon going to be one of the most powerful people in the world. Both of them have the opportunity to be that. Now, both of them, not just today, but throughout the whole week, have been just integrated with so many people telling them, reminding them, here's your talking points, here's what you got to say, here's your take on this. If somebody asks you this question, here's how you avoid it. If someone goes this direction, you go that direction. Over and over, right? And I know one of the main reasons why I don't look forward to the debate, really the main reason why I didn't watch hardly any of the last one, is because I get tired of listening to politicians. The substance of what they say is so hard to find, if it's even there. And you just sit there and you go, it's just, they're just talking around all these things and so on. Now I want you to contrast that. Again, one of these guys is going to be one of the most powerful people in the world. Both of them very powerful, very smart. We can't count that out. They're both well-educated guys. We contrast these two guys, John McCain, Barack Obama, talking about this stuff, with this conversation that we have tonight in John chapter 3. What we have in John 3, especially in light of what we just considered. Did I say something wrong? Oh, I got big eyes going on back there. Maybe someone passed gas or something. I thought, man, I'm self-conscious. I've been sick for the last few weeks, and I can hardly think through the pressure in my head. So I see somebody laugh, and immediately I think, oh, man, what did I say? We contrast the presidential debates with what's going on with Jesus and Nicodemus, and I mean I can't express to you how much I would love to hear that conversation between Jesus and Nicodemus, because we don't have the opportunity to be able to hear the inflection in their voices and to hear their tone of voice and to hear the pauses and to hear and to just see their eye contact. Even just, you know, since we're on the topic of debate, you know, hearing the debate, and that's hearing it, is even different from watching it, right? Because just seeing where, the way the guys look at each other and so on. And here we were able to look at the words, which is huge. And God illuminates these things for us. But imagine that. I mean, this guy comes to Jesus and essentially just, he came there because of all these signs that Jesus had done. And he says that we believe that you're from God, because no one can do these things if you're not from God. And Jesus begins this conversation with him, which is so telling about all the conversations that he wants to have with his people, with anybody for that matter. Because there is so much weight and so much gravity in the things that he says. There's so much power in the give and take of this conversation. And one of the things, perhaps you noticed it, that just amazes me to no end is how specific Jesus' words were to this one guy, and yet how universal the message. We're going to forget what McCain and Obama say in their debate tonight. We're going to forget. Chances are a lot of it will be forgetful. But here we have things going on that are so amazing. They're so specific to this guy. Yet, for God so loved the world, that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever believes in him would not perish but have everlasting life. The universal gospel message for all men. And that's the way Jesus does it. And that's the type of God that we have. One of your guys' questions was along the lines of what is chapter 3, verse 16 reveal about God's heart? And we'll talk about that a little more. But just seeing Jesus willing to spend some time with this guy, just a little bit of time and talk with him, tells us so much about the heart of God and where he's coming from. Jesus is the one that outshadows, that outshines the whole thing that's going on here. Sure, we learn a lot about Nicodemus. And again, I don't really see him as being very cowardly. In fact, he's an interesting guy. Sure, he may have done things that could be considered cowardly, came to Jesus by night, didn't tell the other Pharisees, but consider the implications. A lot of guys that, these Pharisees had a big part in Jesus going to the cross. And what we see is we get a little glimpse of Nicodemus throughout Jesus' life, because later on when the Pharisees are condemning Jesus, Nicodemus stands up, you know, and says, "Hey," you know, and he stands up for Jesus. We also see that Nicodemus went with Joseph of Arimathea to help bury Jesus, which is a big thing. I find it interesting just the fact that we have all the words of this conversation. I think there's a good chance Nicodemus was a part of the early church and shared these very words, and they had such an impact that he was able to remember all of them. But a very interesting guy, no doubt, but really it's Jesus' words that stand out here. And so many times throughout the Gospels, it's one of the amazing things about how Jesus worked and who he was is, I'm sure you guys have sensed this too, but you go to the Gospel, okay, what did Jesus say here? And doesn't it just throw you for a loop just about every time? Even if you know what he's going to say, you're just going, that's so out of left field. I would have never thought about that. That would have never been my response to that question. Have you guys done that in reading the Gospels? And maybe, you know, certainly for some of you that didn't grow up in the church and you got saved and you're like, I'm going to read about this Jesus. And didn't it blow your mind some of the things that he actually said? I mean, he's amazing. And I love the fact that here Nicodemus, he comes up and he makes a statement and Jesus gets directly to the point. One of the applications for us tonight is simply this fact that God knows your deepest need. He wants us to ask him. But before we ask him, he knows. I love the fact that, one of the questions, right, that you guys had, let me see if I can see it, read exactly what it was, we can reference it, but suppose Nicodemus had come to you, question 5, how would you have explained the necessity of being born again? Well, we have to be honest, we would have never even said born again. A guy comes up to you and says, hey, you know, I heard about this Jesus. Jesus responds in the most concise way, right back to him, to his need. If you want to enter heaven, you got to be born again. And that's the way God is. And one thing we find about this conversation is that Jesus was so above where Nicodemus was at, and not because he was being very intellectual and very tricky about the whole thing. Not at all. There's a lot of people that could speak over my head because they might use terms, they might use figures that I'm not familiar with. But that's not what's going on here. What's going on here is you have a guy that's so well-schooled in the Bible, in the Old Testament, and yet he's not tuned in to what really spiritually is important and what's going on. And if you listen to the Lord, if you spend time with Jesus, this same exact thing will happen to you over and over again. Where you go to the Lord and something's on your mind, could be rent, could be work, could be the economy, could be, you know, who's going to be president, could be something in your family. And God, if you listen to him, will answer in a way that's totally different from your question. Just like he did with Nicodemus. Jesus, we know that you're from God. You must be born again. No, that's not what I asked. But it's going to happen. That's the way God works. And it's the way He works when we come to Bible study sometimes. Because we show up and we know what we want to hear and we know what we want an answer for. And maybe we've even been reading and there's one thing that's bugging us. And God will answer you, and chances are it's not going to be the question that you asked. It's going to be deeper, and it's going to be what you really need, because that's the way our God is. He's perfect at it. But again, this idea of being born again, let's not miss it. This is huge. Fortunately, we're at a church where we understand how important it is to be born again. And we call ourselves born again, which another, you could just as well say born from above. It's really the same idea, to be born from above, to be born spiritually. But have you seen those surveys and polls that companies will do, and they come back and they say, 80% of America say they're Christians, 30% say they're born again, 30, and you just kind of step back and you go, what do you mean? And a lot of it is because people of this age are still the same way as Nicodemus. Understanding it on an intellectual level, but not really understanding, I have to die and be born again in Christ. I have to be dead in Jesus and be born again in order for me to enter the kingdom of heaven. Something so spiritual, something so deep that we can miss a lot of times. This guy missed it. A lot of people miss it to this day. We can miss it. Maybe Nicodemus, even hearing the words, got excited. What? I can start over? How cool would that be? But how? And then Jesus goes on to tell him exactly how he would be born again. And essentially, we find it in John 3:16, and we as believers can never forget this. God's heart to us. I'll flip back and read you John 1:18, because I love this verse. No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, He has declared Him. Jesus came from the very heart of God. Jesus, who is in the bosom, the seat of emotions. Jesus came from the heart of God. When we hear His voice, when we see Him heal people and raising the dead and meeting people's needs and loving on them, that is the heart of God. And Jesus, of course, clarifies as much as He can. I'm not here to condemn the world. I'm here so that you can see me, so that when I'm lifted up, like that serpent in the wilderness, like Moses lifted up the serpent, so that you can, as Isaiah said, look to me and be saved. That's the gospel. Look to me. It's not what you can do. It's not how you can do it. It's about what Jesus already did. Don't ever lose sight of how heavy and just how important this truth is. How do we get saved? How do we get born again? We believe and we receive what Jesus has done for us. And that's the message. That's the only way by which you and I are saved. And that's our message to take out. Guys, that's what we need to take to others. Because there are a lot of Nicodemuses. Really, we're all Nicodemuses in the sense that we come to Jesus with questions deeper than anybody can ask. Just Nicodemus showing up that night tells us that he had studied and studied. He did have a real heart for God, but he hadn't found what he needed. There were still some big questions that the greatest leaders and teachers and Bible students of his time couldn't answer. So he came to Jesus. Guys, I'm telling you, come to Jesus with your needs. Come to Him. Let Him answer the questions to your heart. Mm-hmm. there's a big transition in chapter 3, verses 22 and on, where really we see John the Baptist, and as far as the big picture of not just the Gospel of John, but with the ministry of Jesus as a whole, and with God's work as a whole, we see not just John decreasing and Jesus increasing, but we see really the old covenant decreasing, and we see the new covenant increasing. Up to that point, the message, Matthew tells us early on what John's message was. It was repent from your sins. It was you are sinners. But things change. Not, well, they're made better in the sense that the Lamb of God, the sacrifice for those sins, appears on the scene. And so in the big picture, we're going to see John really decrease because he's going to go to jail soon, and he's not going to make it out of jail. But I think there's a lot of application for us here as guys. As you look at John, I hope that you are just... this is the next point. That's John the Baptist decreasing and Jesus increasing. There's a lot that we can learn. I hope that you are impressed by John's character, because there's a lot of humility, real humility, because it's tested and tried here. He's pointing to Jesus. That's all he's doing. He knew that was his calling in life, and he was going to do it to the end. I'm just going to point to Jesus. That's what I'm here for. A lot of humility there. There's some serious things that you and I can learn. One thing we can really learn from is in verse 27, where it says, John answered and said, a man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from heaven. Now, in a general sense, of course, we know from James 1:17 that every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. In other words, everything good that you and I have, everything that's going to last, that's from the Lord. Our very breath is from the Lord. But specifically what John's talking about here, he's talking about life calling. He's comparing his life calling to Jesus' life calling. So he's not just talking about breakfast. He's not just talking about, you wake up in the morning and you go, you know, okay, this bowl of cereal's from God and thank you. And then when you're out of cereal, oh man, you know, no good gift from God today. It's just talking about a life calling. And for you and I, as men, I just want to ask you, do you believe what John says in verse 27? He says that a man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from heaven. And the question to you personally from the Lord is, do you really believe this? Do you know this to be true? Are you willing in your life to trust God for what he gives you and to wait on him to receive it? Or do you want what you want when you want it? And these decisions come up daily, but also just as a whole in life. The way you live your life answers this question. Do I believe that I can receive nothing worthwhile unless it comes from God? Because you and I know that the world absolutely does not believe this. This would be checked false in a true-false question by the majority of people in this world. Business world, whatever way you want to look at it. Because the bottom line is what we're told is if you want something, you better go get it. And if you don't get it, then someone else is going to get it first. And if you want more, you need to go get more. This is ingrained into us as a society, but it's also just born into us because we're selfish. I want that. I can't handle seeing someone else get it. I can't handle waiting to get it. I'm going to get it. Even if it's something that we're sure is good, right? That's normally our excuse anyways. This is something good. I better go get it now. But guys, the principle from God, the God-ordained principle, is that He's the one that gives good gifts. And a man can really receive nothing unless it's given by Him. It's going to test your faith, but that's part of the point. It's going to mean closed doors. It's going to mean no in areas where you wish it were yes. That's the way it is. I encourage you guys to consider those areas in your life, small and big. Most importantly, big. Just as you look at life and you consider how you go about things with your family and your work and just your future here on earth, are you paying attention to what God's will is? Or are you doing it your way? Because the cool thing about it is this, is God has put a calling on every single one of our lives. Every single one of you here, God has placed a calling. We look at John the Baptist. See, I love the way it's presented in John chapter 4, because John the Baptist had a calling. It was to be a voice. And you know what? John never asked to be more than that, but he also never settled for less than that. And that's the key, because you and I often fall on one extreme to the other. We either see a calling that God hasn't given to us and we want it so bad, or maybe even because of that, we've gone on the other extreme and gone, I don't even know what my calling is. I probably don't have a calling. I'm not ever going to find a calling, and so on. One of those extremes. And guys, the key to serving the Lord and also to just our purpose here on earth is to know what that calling is. Now, you could say, oh, well, it was easier for John the Baptist to know what his calling was. And I agree, because he was specifically called by God. But his calling wasn't easier. You know, the chances of yours or mine, our heads ending up on a platter after we're decapitated in prison are minimal. I don't know what the actual probability is, but it's low. He had a calling. The Lord showed it to him. I don't think Rudy would mind me sharing this with you. If he does, I'm in trouble. But Rudy shared with me one time that shortly after he was saved, he just felt real clear. And in fact, his pastor at the time asked him, and this, how many years have you been saved? 81. And shortly thereafter, his pastor just said, well, is there anything, you know, that you really feel like the Lord's kind of put a calling on or leading you in a direction? And Rudy's answer then, and this is big because most young Christians don't think this, but he said, I think the Lord has called me to pray for people. Now, that was 1981, and you guys know him in 2008. Has anything changed? He knows that that's what the Lord has called him to do, and the Lord's poured out His Spirit upon him to that end. And many of you guys know it, and you've been blessed by it. The Lord's given you a calling. Maybe you know what it is and you're on the right track. Maybe you have no idea what it is, or maybe you've forgotten what it is, either by application or really because of just the busyness of life and everything going on around you. You go, I think that was it at one time, but so many things have clouded between then and now that I can't really say that that's my calling and so on. But guys, we're not going to be content, and we're not going to be where the Lord wants us, and we're not really going to be usable unless we're doing exactly what the Lord's called us to do. And remember, we each have our place. We don't get a pick, but we do have our place. And if you find yourself either being disappointed or wanting a calling that you just plain don't have, or on the other extreme and just going, oh, there is no calling and so on, then you're miserable. you're miserable and you probably are in many facets. But the principle here in John 4 from John the Baptist, and especially in John 27, and where he says, he must increase, but I must decrease, there's so much truth in it. Real humility, which acknowledges, because when you understand this principle, you know, okay, the natural gifts that I have, they're from God to begin with. And then the spiritual things that the Lord blessed me with, that's from God too. So you don't have a problem. So many of us, when the Lord uses us, we struggle between the whole, well, part of that was because I'm just great. And then the other part was for sure because of God. But with this principle, we just understand, hey, I'm where the Lord wants me. It's the most natural feeling ever because it's what the Lord created us for. And he can use us in the most supernatural ways imaginable. I'm going to give you time, you guys, a little bit of time to pray about it at your tables. And I want to encourage you just to pray exactly this about what we've been talking about with John the Baptist here. Because it's personal. It's about our calling that the Lord's given us. And not, it doesn't have to be. For most of us, it won't be missionary, pastor, this and that. What is it? Well, to pray for people. Well, to help somebody financially. Well, my calling is to be a good dad. My calling is to be a good husband. My calling is to, be a witness at work. Those are all just as important. And any time had John decided, oh, I don't want to be the voice, it doesn't work. Had somebody else decided, I want to be the voice, it doesn't work. So guys, I want you to pray to that end. Just right now, go ahead and bow your heads and give you about 10 minutes so that you can pray over these things.